First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me over to be surrounded by a bunch of mathematicians, which is a pleasure, and some physicists, that's okay. And secondly, the organizers asked me to present an introductory talk, so I have to apologize in advance for the low level of this talk, which is truly going mostly to be introductory. The advanced part, if I ever get to it, will be at the end, and it will therefore be incomprehensible. Now I'll start with the talk itself. The subject is granular gases, and let me put it to you like this. Imagine a world in which atoms are not of the size of angstroms, but rather of the size of oranges. A world in which you can see the motion of each atom, follow it, see it colliding with other atoms, take pictures with your camera and analyze them later. And so experiments are relatively simple, and still you can test many of the fundamental ideas of statistical mechanics and kinetic theory. Such a world, more or less, with some exceptions, does exist, and this is the world of granular materials. Granular materials, by definition, are macroscopic solid particles, usually taken to be larger than 1 micron, at least on Earth, so that Brownian motion and quantum effects can be safely ignored. And so you have classical mechanics, and you have systems of such grains, which there are many similarities to atomic systems, where the analogy is atom is, or the grain can be considered for many purposes like an atom. And indeed, this analogy has impressed quite a few great minds, like this French gentleman, who said, who could ever calculate the path of a molecule? Those who don't know English, there's the French translation. How do we know that the creation of worlds are not determined by falling grains of sand? So here, at least, is a good motivation to go into this field. And speaking of the creation of worlds, indeed, many objects in outer space are granular materials. One of the beautiful granular systems is actually Saturn's rings and many other planetary rings. This is a picture taken by Voyager, who actually went through the Saturn's rings. And as you can see, there is this wonderful inner structure. These rings are made, unlike the moon that's well known to be made of yellow cheese, right? These rings are made of ice particles whose sizes range from microns to meters, many meters, or feet, should I say. In Canada it's meters, right? All right. So this is a celestial application. There are many more celestial applications that I'm not going to talk about, but there are also other applications, many other applications of great importance to industry. This is actually a comical pile in a quarry made of stones. And as you can see, this was not designed to be conical, but it's almost perfectly conical. And it's a subject of studies that I'm not going to describe. And here is a very relaxing application, if you can see it. This is an automatic silo in Texas, so the farmer who lives 2 days' drive from there can feed his cows without ever or hardly ever being there. And there are essentially two kinds of granular materials here. One is the one that the cows eat, and the other, forget it. Now, the profession of granular materials is also involves some dangers. And here is an example of one of the dangers in this field. This is a collapsing silo. There are 1,000 cases on average like this in the United States. The silo collapses, and if the material inside is poisonous or you're too close to the silo, then you probably may not have a chance to tell about it. And so this is something that worries engineers and many other people, how to design those silos so that they are stable and do not collapse that easily. So this is a rather important field from an engineering point of view. And as a matter of fact, you may not know, but about 30-40% of electricity in the United States, I'm mentioning the US because there are statistics there, goes to the crushing of granular material. That's an enormous amount. And here is another example of granular material. That's a mudslide, and the villagers there who are asleep don't know what's happening, and it's a very unpleasant situation for them. Not anymore. And so this granular materials are about 80% of the materials in the chemical industry, and for this audience, they exhibit an enormous amount of exotic or interesting properties that deserve to be studied. And this is why people like Coulomb, the same Coulomb from electrostatics, studied granular materials. He studied the angle of repose, or the equilibrium angle of a sand pile. Hagen and Reynolds, quite famous personalities, for example, in fluid mechanics, studied the flow of granular materials. And actually, an interesting observation here is that Hagen did his studies in 1852, Reynolds in 1885, and these are considered simultaneous studies. And so the effect they discovered, which I'm not going to discuss, it's a very important effect called the latency, is called the Hagen-Reynolds dilatancy effect. So they had time. Rankine is a very well-known personality in this field, and Janssen, all of this is, except for Coulomb, is 19th century. There's quite a few studies of that. The field remained of interest to engineers for obvious reasons, because of the many applications, but in the early 80s, it sort of returned to physics, because many physicists discovered that there are interesting patterns, this is from the Science magazine, to be observed in granular materials. What you see here is sort of a frying pan in which you put grains, in this case it's little sphere ball, and just shake it up and down. And then you observe patterns on the surface which take on various, you can see defects here, and then you have circular and hexagonal and all the kinds of patterns that you also see in fluids. And this is actually one of the reasons, not the only one, that people started being interested in granular materials in the physics community. And there are some strange patterns, one of them, one of which is known as the oscillon. It made it into the cover of the Nature magazine. An oscillon, it's again in the same frying pan that you shake. This is a geyser-like stable excitation. However, to get there, to create it, you have to go through a special route, and this is, it goes up and down, and you can see it as stable. And not only is it stable, you can create a whole field here of such oscillons. There is still an argument whether the oscillon can be described by hydrodynamic equations or not. I will not go into this type of controversy here, but it seems that with an appropriate minor modification of hydrodynamics that follows from the corresponding Boltzmann equation, which I am going to show, you can probably explain the existence of the oscillon. Another interesting effect that was discovered by the police in Rio de Janeiro is known as the Brazil nut effect. when you have a box with nuts that you collect from trees, nuts grow on trees, not in supermarkets, and you shake them up and down, like in the trucks that bring them from the trees to Rio de Janeiro and then to the port, the big nuts go up against gravity. And the result was that the drivers could steal the big and more expensive nuts, and so the nuts that got to the consumer were small. And this effect was discovered by the Brazilian police, and it was discovered, well, but it was published. That's what counts. It was published by the Brazilian police, who actually understood what was going on after one of the drivers became a policeman, as a matter of fact. So it's always good to have insider information. So this is a rather interesting effect. It turns out that if you use a hex instead of a nut, it will go down. But again, this is a technical detail that I'm not going to dwell upon. And the other field, which I'm not going to touch at all, is granular statics. There's enormous controversy going on here. It's the physics of the sandbox, and actually it is not yet clear, or at least it seems not to be completely clear, whether the equations describing it are elliptic or hyperbolic. What is clear by now that they're not parabolic, so one is out. This is the granular statics problem. So this brings me to today's subject, which is the granular gas. Now, how do you get a granular gas? Again, you go to your kitchen, if you know where it is, and you take the frying pan, put some grains or peas inside. When you shake them, they start jumping up, and when they start jumping up, they collide with each other, and they thermalize in terms of their distribution. Doesn't mean that the distribution is Gaussian, but they thermalize. They get to some kind of equilibrium distribution of velocities, and this is one way, not the only way, to get a granular gas where you have particles colliding. This is, for example, why the notion of temperature for a granular gas has nothing to do with the inner temperature of the grains. This is the thermodynamic temperature. We're talking about the kinetic energy of the grains and call it the granular temperature, or in short, temperature. Now, what I'm going to talk here is a result of many collaborations with students and other colleagues, and I would like just to mention two of them: Mengli Tan, who is very successful in Wall Street, and Yangti Zhang, who is also doing very well in Wall Street, which means that the study of granular materials can actually be useful for your future if you're a student. It helps. And as I mentioned, physicists have a tendency to simplify matters. Granular materials collide inelastically, but they're hardly ever spherical unless you make them spherical. In nature, they're not. And the standard description that is used for the collision of granular materials, it's a highly oversimplified description, is that of an inelastic collision. Yeah, of spheres. You have two spheres. K hat here is called the normal direction. It connects the centers of the spheres. You have two incoming spheres. The relative velocity of sphere I and sphere J, that's the difference of V I and V J, in the normal direction, changes direction upon collision, of course, and is multiplied by the coefficient of restitution E. E is between 0 and 1, otherwise you gain kinetic energy in a collision and you solve the energy problem of the world. So that's why the coefficient of restitution better be smaller than 1. In practice, the coefficient of restitution is velocity dependent, but for thermal velocities or typical velocities, there is a flat plateau of the values of the coefficient of restitution. That is sort of a justification to assume it is fixed. The other myth I would like to dispel is that in high school books it says that the energy goes into heat. This is about 20% true. 80% of the energy in inelastic collisions goes into the creation of microcracks in the grains and not into increasing the temperature or heating them up. Yes, please. For small enough grains, yes. I'm not going to talk about that. I'm not going to talk about many things. Electrostatic effect is one of them. Okay? All right. So, it seems that we have a realization of a neutral gas, where we can look at it and see things with our own eyes or with a camera, but still this gas is very, very different from regular gases. And, for example, the size. Well, size, as you know, doesn't matter. However, due to that size, the collisions are inelastic. Grains are macroscopic. Moreover, the size of the grain says that basically quantum mechanics can ignore it. Except for that, you have a classical model of a gas. The collisions are inelastic. This is a major, major, major feature that affects all the properties. In practice, the number of grains, because they're macroscopic, is much smaller than the Avogadro number. So fluctuations are terribly important. It turns out they're important also inherently. Even if we had an Avogadro number of grains, fluctuations would have played a major role. I'm not going to talk about boundary conditions, but they are different from the regular from regular fluids, for example. And as I said, the coefficient of restitution is velocity dependent and the time also history dependent. Now, there's another feature that I'm going to stress later, but I'm already telling you that. Granular gases usually have no scale separation. They're sort of in the transition region, and this determines a lot of their features. Most granular flows are supersonic and have very small, if at all, scale separation, so one should be very careful in applying methods like the Chapman-Enskog expansion, which is based on scale separation. Still, the hydrodynamic equations describe the flow or many features of the flows of granular materials very, very well. And people have looked at Poiseuille flow. This is a very simple experiment to make the measurements are not simple, where you have an inclined plane known in the jargon of this field as a chute. You have particles coming in and you have flow in between these two plates. And the results, amazingly, are in good agreement with hydrodynamics based on the kinetics here. This is a very nice experiment by Joël Forter and Olivier Pouliquen in Marseille. Again, a chute flow. The depth of this flow is about 5 grain diameters. This is, from any point of view, almost as microscopic as you can get, the microscopic scale being 1 grain diameter, and they observe transverse waves which are typical of the hydrodynamic solution there. So hydrodynamics is doing much better than one would have expected it to do. Here's another case where hydrodynamics work. These are 2 fluids of different density flowing down the chute. It's grains of different color, but also of different density. And you see the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. I assume that everybody here knows about the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. It's visible here also. And here is a shock wave that you can actually see. This is a flow, again, down an inclined plane with a wedge. It's an experiment it's not the first shockwave experiment in the field, but it's very nice. It's done by the Harry Swinney group in Austin, Texas. So you have these particles flowing down, there's a wedge, and you can look at averaged quantities. It's very easy to look at the average quantities here of the flow field. This is experiment, molecular dynamics, and this is the Navier-Stokes equation. I would say that at least qualitatively, all of these methods, and are doing very well. You can improve by using Burnet and Super Burnet and what have you, but they really improve the solution towards what is observed in real life experiment. And this kind of experiment, you can just watch over and see the shockwave with your bare eyes, including the inner structure of the shockwave. Remember that the typical shockwave in air has a width of 10, 20, 30 angstroms. Here, the shockwave has a width of 20 centimeters. You can actually look at it and enjoy it. So, is this all of this surprising? Yes, it is surprising. It is surprising because all the assumptions that go into the derivation of hydrodynamic descriptions are not necessarily valid for granular materials. For example, what is equilibrium? If you leave the granular materials alone, a granular gas, you don't pump energy into it, then because the collisions are inelastic, the energy will decay and eventually it will fall down on your table. If there's no gravity, it will not fall down, but it'll go to zero temperature. So there's no equilibrium. There is something close to equilibrium. It's called the homogeneous cooling state, which is a state that's good only for equations because it doesn't exist in reality. The homogeneous cooling state is a state where you start off from a homogeneous isotropic distribution of the particles, isotropic in velocity, homogeneous in density, and the energy decays homogeneously. Problem is, this state is unstable to clustering, so the homogeneity, any homogeneous state, is unstable, and so it's not a sort of a good prototypical state, but it's being used for various purposes that I may or may not reach to talk about. Equipartition doesn't hold, and again, I'll repeat this statement many times so that you'll remember at least one statement from this talk. Namely, there is lack of scale separation. That's very, very important. So, what does the inelasticity do to us? Well, I already told you, it does. There is no homogeneous state, there is no equipartition, there is lack of scale separation, and this means that the system is essentially always in a state of non-equilibrium. Any granular system, no matter how you look at it, is in a state of non-equilibrium. And by the way, here is a proof that the scent pile, which is not a gas, is also in a non-equilibrium or at least metastable state. Because if you kick the scent pile, then all the grains will be on the ground. You lower the potential energy. And so obviously the scent pile itself couldn't have been a minimum of energy. All right? So here is a very simple proof. All you have to do is this, and it's proven. So the other thing is that since the relative velocities along the normal, remember the line connecting the centers, decrease upon collision, the velocities get more and more parallel during the collision. This is bad news for anybody who wants to believe in molecular chaos. It means that incoming particles in a collision already are correlated. Is this important? Well, in some cases it is. Now, it isn't. And then there's a phenomenon called collapse, which I'll describe a little bit later, which involves an infinite number of collisions in a finite time, again, a problem for the Boltzmann equation. And if I ever get to it towards the end of my talk, that depends on the chairman, I guess, I'll discuss frictional effects, which change the physics in a rather interesting way. And by the way, real granular materials have frictional effects. They are frictional. They're microscopic. They're friction. So, just to summarize part of this introduction, we have new mathematics here on top of the new physics, and that is the Boltzmann equation has to account at least for the inelasticity, so it has to be studied. You need, if you want to do a perturbative expansion like a Chapman-Enskog, it has to be different because standard equilibrium is not a natural thing. Again, lack of scale separation. Did I say that before? Yes, I did. There is no H theorem there. No, there is no H theorem in this system. At least none is known and probably doesn't exist. This has to do with denser gases, fluctuation dissipation theorems. Those do exist. We've proven some. And they're different from the standard. And boundary conditions are a pain here, but can be derived. So all of this sort of renders these systems quite interesting, and they should also be interesting to mathematicians. And some mathematicians have actually taken up this field because it's really an unexplored class of systems where you can apply the Boltzmann equation, and you can get grants because of the many applications and the current interest, so it's very important. And you go essentially to the transition region where you're at the boundary validity of hydrodynamics. Non-Boltzmann effects are also important, but these require a separate talk. So this is more or less an introduction, it's a very general introduction. So let me tell you, since I don't know how much I'll be able to tell you in detail, what the major results we got on this are. Well, we can derive hydrodynamics to Burnett order for monodispersed, that means one kind of particles, bidispersed, two kinds of particles, with or without frictional interactions. It turns out the homogeneous cooling state, this unstable state, which is a solution of the Boltzmann equation, has non-trivial distributions. It's non-Gaussian, for example, non-Maxwellian. Lack of scale separation. Normal stress differences means that the pressure is anisotropic. It will come as a surprise to some of you, but the pressure, even in air, is anisotropic. The degree of anisotropy is 10 to the minus 20 in air, so it's not important. The Burnett effect. In granular materials, it's order one. It can be 40%. So it enhances, it amplifies some effects that you see in molecular systems to order one effect from nothing, essentially. Response theory is possible to do there. You get fluctuation dissipation theorem. I will not talk about elasticity, force change. Clustering I may get to talk about. And then you can describe shockwaves here and look at them at the same time, because the width of the shockwave, as I said, is quite large. So now let's discuss in detail at least one effect that's typical of granular materials, and it's obviously not a simple kinetic effect. That is the collapse phenomenon. And let me explain what collapse is. You can use your high school physics textbook to understand collapse. You drop a ball from height h to the floor. You can see there I have this ball that drops to the floor. As you may remember from high school or from playing with a ball, it doesn't quite go up to the same height when you drop it. And the height it goes up to is the coefficient of restitution square of the ball with the floor, of course, times the previous height. So you have a very simple recursion relation for the consecutive heights of the ball. I remember I taught elementary mechanics to electrical engineers, and I taught them this example. They wanted an electrical example, so I said, well, let's drop a radio on the floor from height H. So this is just a mechanical example, and of course, if the heights decrease in a geometric series, and they go to zero eventually. But the other thing that is not described in elementary textbooks, although it's as elementary, is the time it takes to go from here to here to here. It's also a geometric series. The time from one maximum to the other maximum to the third maximum. And it turns out that this time, from, say, peak n to peak n plus 1, is related to the time from peak n plus 1 to peak n plus 2, by a factor of only one coefficient of restitution. You can sum it up, E is less than one. So in a finite time, this idealized system makes an infinity of collisions and is relaxed. This is called collapse. It's not something that the Boltzmann equation can describe, because the number of collisions here diverges in a finite time. You can modify it to do that, but at least offhand, it doesn't do it. It's a very simple effect that sort of escaped notice for some time, and it does exist when you don't force the system. At least in 3D, in three dimensions, it is hardly existent, because what happens in reality, you don't have a floor, you have a particle colliding with other particles that act like a floor, And usually there's an energetic particle at the, some time that comes sideways and just opens up the string of particles. So this is never fully completed in a real three-dimensional system, but it can happen in 2D. Another interesting effect, which I mentioned before, is called clustering. Clustering was predicted by us, in about, I think in 91 or something like that, and we had no idea at the time that they see it in industry all the time, but theoreticians said that would be impossible. Eventually, I think it's accepted now. Here's a simple experiment. Again, spheres rolling down an inclined plane, and they like to cluster. I'll show you later a little bit more sophisticated experimental results which exhibit the clustering phenomenon. Clustering means that you, if, even if you start off from a homogeneous density in a granular system and you don't force anything, then spontaneously you will get instabilities that lead to dense region called clusters and more dilute regions called non-clusters. How does this happen? Well, the mechanism is so simple you don't even need equations. Or at least in this talk there won't be any concerning this mechanism. Here's the mechanism. You have, say, a system of grains that collide with each other. They can be forced or not forced, doesn't matter. Now, since this is a statistical system, everything fluctuates, so you can have a density fluctuation. In some region, the density will spontaneously be slightly larger than in other regions. It's a density fluctuation, which means you have a denser region. Now, the number of collisions per unit time is proportional to the square of the number density. But each such collision is inelastic. The more such collisions you have, the more energy you lose. So the result is that in a denser system, there is cooling, namely the granular temperature or the kinetic energy decreases faster than in the ambient, which is not dense, and therefore the pressure is lower. But if the pressure is lower, particles will go into there from the dilute regions. So here, unlike in regular hydrodynamic systems, the particles move from where there are few particles, the dilute regions, into the dense regions, therefore amplifying, there's a nonlinear process there, the dense regions and increasing their density. The way to remember this is that usually money flows from the poor to the rich and not the other way around. So this is the economic equivalent, I guess, of clustering. There's also some scales that are typical of clustering, and which I will not probably go into. And the result is that clustering has an enormous effect on many flows. Let me show you some examples. Here's a two-dimensional set of disks, homogeneous Gaussian distributed velocity. If you don't force them, then after quite a short time, you see strings of particles with which are the clusters. This is a shear system, so the velocity at this boundary goes to the left, at that boundary it goes to the right, and in this shear system you can observe clusters, and as a matter of fact you can even observe multi-stability that has to do with the clusters. If you start with a very energetic initial conditions, the initial condition, then the boundary conditions don't matter that much because it has a lot of energy inside. You get a similar picture to that. If it's less energetic, you get that picture with clusters that are aligned at around 45 degrees to the shear flow. And I expect a question here from hydrodynamicists, but if there is none, then I won't answer it. Yes? That's true. If you change the rate of shear, you create a lot of energy near the walls, you heat the system, so the cluster is created in the center and it gives rise to plug flow. That's another manifestation of clustering. But I think the most beautiful manifestation of clustering that I can describe to you is called the Maxwell-Deemann effect. Here's If I find, Yes, here it is. Yes, please. The velocity distribution in this case is going to be quite non-Gaussian, if that's the question. Yes. Of course. Yes, you can measure it, sure. It's been measured there. I know the details. It's been published in Physics of Fluids, 92, whatever. You mean the tail? The tail from this kind of simulations you cannot measure with any accuracy because these are rare events. I can only tell you what the bulk of the distribution is. The tail, you have to do an enormously long simulation to measure the rare events. I can tell you theoretically what the tail is there later. Oh, this is when you change the shear rate. When you change the shear rate, you inject energy at the boundaries. When you inject a lot of energy at the boundaries, you heat the region next to the boundaries, and the cooler regions move away because the pressure is higher where it's more dilute and hot. That's the clustering effect. So you create a plug in the middle. And as a matter of fact, there's an wavy instability here, which I didn't mention because I want to cheat you. All right? There's some physics there that I'm not mentioning because I have only 1 hour.
So the bottom row, the shear flow, the shear on the wall is faster?
Yeah, you change the shear rate, and then you induce immediate clustering and the plug flow. Yes. Which means that fluctuating changes can do the same thing. Eventually, this is a metastable state. The stable state is the plug. All right. And here... How much time do I have, by the way? Sorry? I didn't ask until up to when. How much time is left? 20 minutes. Okay, because I want to show the Boltzmann equation. All right. Here's the Maxwell Demon effect. It's again related to clustering. And... You want to see it? Oh, it's unstable. Okay, it's stable now. This is a very trivial experiment, first performed by a group of teachers in Germany and published in a teacher's journal, physics teacher's journal. What's going on here? You have some kind of container, and you have a partition with a hole. Do you see the hole? All right. Now, you put all your grains on one side or on both sides, doesn't matter how you distribute them, and you start vibrating up and down. Now, normally you would expect the pressures on both sides to equilibrate and to have more or less the same numbers of particles on both sides. But this is grains. Imagine that you start clustering, which is a stochastic process, here on this side. So you have a big cluster, which is cold, namely of low kinetic energy, and it doesn't go through the hole anymore. So the particles on the other side of the partition will flow to this side, and nobody will come back. So eventually, all the particles will go to one side of the partition. And this is called the Maxwell-Demon effect in granular materials. You can describe that theoretically. So you start with a condition, for example, like this. Everybody goes to the other side. And of course, if you take a different vessel, because it's fluctuating, you can get them to be on this side. It doesn't matter. So this is, and you can separate materials that way also. I'm not going to talk about that either. So, sorry? Oh, the clusters move around, yes. No, it's not a cat. It will not change its size to just go through the cluster. It will jump up and down, but since it's very massive, it will hardly reach the hole. Okay? And even if it reaches the hole, it will eject a few... There is a flux back, but it's very small because the cluster is cold. Okay? Even if the cluster is allowed to touch the hole, the velocities are so small there that the flux back from the cluster is very small. Most of the flux comes into. Okay? This is a very beautiful experiment which a group in Enschede has been playing with in recent years, in generalizing to N boxes, and it turns out that there are bifurcations there, and lots of mathematics to be done. The head of this group is Detlef Lohse. You may read their papers in mostly in Physical Review and other journals. So let me tell you why, again, granular materials exhibit interesting effects among them like this, because they're mesoscopic. Mesoscopic, again, is lack of scale separation. There's lack of temporal and spatial scale separation. There are long-range velocity correlations, which I sort of hinted at. There are strong stress fluctuations. Maxwell's demon I've just shown you, and lots of other structures which are interesting. However, as I mentioned before, you can still describe many, many of these features by using an equation that is sort of almost the queen of this conference, namely the Boltzmann equation. Now, this is not the Vlasov equation. There are collisions. They are important. The right-hand side is not thrown away. This is the full Maxwell equation for inelastically colliding hard spheres. And E is the coefficient of restitution, but this is the not the only place where E appears. This is where it appears explicitly. It also appears implicitly in the velocities here, because these are the pre-collisional velocities that would give you V1, V2 upon collision. So they're the relation between V1 prime and V2 prime to the V1 and V2, the pre-collisional to post-collisional, involves the coefficient of restitution. So there's it's hidden here, here, and explicitly mentioned there. You can look at moments of the Boltzmann equation and get continuum equations for the hydrodynamic variables. This is the equation of continuity. This is the stress tensor and the momentum equation. The temperature, theta is the temperature here, equation has one more term, and that's a sink term for the energy that's lost in the collision. It comes out from the algebra there. And here is the sink term. Obviously, when E is 1, there's an elastic, the collisions are elastic, the sink term disappears. You go back to the regular continuum equations. But of course, this is not a closed system. You need constitutive relations, which is what I would like to show you next. I think something is wrong with my watch. 20 minutes? Okay, 20 minutes. Okay, let's try to see how we can solve the Boltzmann equation, or at least solve it perturbatively when you have a granular system. I'll show you two methods. One is good for stationary states. One is good for time-dependent states. So consider, for example, simple shear. So you have a flow in the x direction that varies, where the velocity varies in the y direction. Everything all right? Okay. That's the boundaries, yes. Okay. Yes. And what is the question then?
How does that enter into your...
It does not enter the Boltzmann equation in the bulk. It enters the boundary. At the boundaries, you have to take into account the accommodation function, and you have to do some work to get the boundary condition on the continuum equation. It's been done. All right? Okay, so here is simple shear flow. Simple shear flow for granular materials in the absence of gravity provides the only scale of time in the problem. Gamma has dimensions of inverse time. So so this is your clock. There's nothing else in the problem that has dimensions related to time when there is no gravity. Remember that. This means, and this is also a result of analysis, that the temperature, which has dimensions of velocity squared, that's the fluctuating velocity square, the mean square velocity, must be proportional to gamma square, because gamma square has dimensions of 1 over time square. The typical scale for length is the mean free path, which is given here in terms of the total collisional cross-section. And so the temperature must be proportional to gamma square L, the mean free path square. It's also inversely proportional to the degree of inelasticity, which is basically 1 minus the coefficient of restitution squared, namely when E is 1, it's elastic. The reason is that the granulate or the temperature will diverge when there is no sink for the energy. You shear a system, you put work on it, so the energy will increase indefinitely, and so the temperature must be inversely proportional, well, in principle, to a function of epsilon. In practice, you can show it's actually epsilon itself. I mean, the dimensional argument won't tell you if it's epsilon cube or whatever other function, but this is the result. This is the temperature there. And now let's look what happens. And C is a coefficient of order 1. It's about 3 in 3 dimensions and 1 in 2 dimensions. Now let's look what happens as the shear rate goes to 0, so you pump less energy. But at the same time, the parameter epsilon, the degree of elasticity, goes to 0 while keeping the temperature constant. In this limit, shear rate goes to 0, epsilon goes to 0, but the ratio is fixed, gamma squared is proportional to epsilon. You can keep the temperature, but then you have no forcing and no sink. This is called equilibrium. So there is a limit in which you can connect the case, in this case it's simple shear flow, to regular equilibrium, and you can do a perturbation theory around equilibrium if you adhere here to the thing that gamma square must be proportional to epsilon. Then obviously the small parameter is square root of epsilon, and then you do the expansion. I will not show you technical details of the expansion because it's rather straightforward, and here are some of the results. The granular temperature in this steady-state shear flow is given as anticipated on the basis of dimensional argument by gamma square L square, and then the lowest order here in epsilon is proportional to epsilon because there's a square here. Notice that, and then there's a whole series that you can calculate. Now, notice please that when you calculate the stress in the xx direction, you divide it by the yy direction, you get a number that is sort of, you get 1.5 for the parameters mentioned here. It's a change of order 1 with respect to the, say, ratio of 1, which is what you expect from the normal stress being pressure. Okay? Now, this comes out because the stress has a correction that this one, this is a Burnett correction. You can see shear rate squared there. But the Burnett correction here is almost as important as the Navier-Stokes original term. And since the reason, again, is the lack of scale separation, and so this gives you a very strong normal stress anisotropy, which is observed in actual experiments. Now, there are some other things that are interesting with respect to this lack of scale separation. Let me show you later at least one feature of the lack of scale separation that's again done for the case of simple shear. The mean free time, roughly, is the mean free path over the thermal speed. All right? Now, the thermal speed, as I said before, is given as L squared gamma squared over epsilon times the constant. Remember, it was in the previous transparency, and it's also written there for those whose memory is very short. So if you do that, you divide the mean free path by the formula for the typical speed. The mean free path cancels out because there's a square of L square, and you get that the mean free time is proportional to 1 over the shear rate. But 1 over the shear rate is the macroscopic time scale. All right? That's what you impose on your system. So the ratio of the mean free time to the macroscopic time scale is basically the square root of the degree of inelasticity, and that's an order 1 number. So the mean free time and the shear rate are of the same order of magnitude. There is no scale separation. When epsilon is very small, you're nearly elastic, you regain scale separation. All right? Otherwise, you have no scale separation. You have to worry about your Chapman-Enskog results. Another result, and that is when you do it in a more general way, namely, you expand, and this is the generalization of Chapman-Enskog, you expand both in the Knudsen number, essentially in gradient, and epsilon, because when epsilon is zero, it's the elastic limit where you know something. But that's only good for small epsilons, because otherwise there's no scale separation. You have a double expansion instead of a gradient expansion like Chapman-Enskog. Then you can actually get hydrodynamic equations. And here are some of the constitutive relations you see. Please ignore everything. These are Burnett terms. The first line says as follows. You have a heat flux that's proportional to the temperature gradient. No big deal. But also another term that's proportional to the gradient of the number density. So you have a non-Fourier heat law here that has to do with the inelasticity, and that's quite exotic to see such a term. This term has been measured in experiments, and it's an excellent agreement with the theoretical calculations here. All the prefactors here are epsilon dependent. They depend on the degree of inelasticity that you have in your system. And I will not show you the stress, it's boring, but this is the energy sink term. The energy sink term appears in the equation for the energy. It's the leading order, these are Burnett terms again, the leading order is proportional to temperature to the power 3 over 2. The reason is that in every collision, energy is on average changed by a certain factor. That explains one power of the temperature. And then the flux is proportional to square root of temperature. Altogether, you get theta to the power 3 over 2. This is the hit-and-run explanation where this power comes from. And I hope it's sort of clear. This gives rise, these results that show that you need the Burnett terms to describe properly the hydrodynamics should remind you of the fact that Burnett equations are ill-posed, a la Adamard, and you need to do something about it. There are various resummation schemes. The most recent is due to Marshall Slemrod and students who actually took our equations and regularized them in a certain way. This is sort of ad hoc regularization, so we're not sure yet whether this regularization is actually what nature wants, but it has to be checked. And then there are other problems. Burnett terms diverge, but I'm not going into that. One of the possible solutions to avoid these problems, and this actually also goes into Slemrod's trick, is to increase the number of fields. I know the number of hydrodynamic fields. I know one case in which this was done. We actually did a one-dimensional case where you can do things better than in higher dimensions. And there, if you increase the number of hydrodynamic fields by 2, you get everything to be regular, well-posed, and so on. And those of you who know statistical mechanics should be surprised, because according to statistical mechanics, there is no one-dimensional hydrodynamics. Colliding particles elastically exchange velocities, so initial distributions are preserved. But when you have inelasticity, they're randomized. And so you can have one-dimensional hydrodynamics in granular systems. Okay? And indeed, there, if you increase the number of fields, you can get interesting results. So now, I still have 10 minutes or so? Okay. So these are results that we've developed over the years, certainly not all of them, in the field of granular gases. And now let me get to some relatively recent results that I would like to describe to you very briefly, and that is the effect of friction. You know, macroscopic particles experience friction. It is not only that the relative velocity in the normal direction changes, there's also tangential forces when they meet and collide, and this is described by friction. And what do you do then? This is real life. So real grains are frictional, and there are lots of important consequences of friction. For example, in frictional dense systems, the stress tensor is not symmetric. This gives rise to a class of theories known as Cossera theories, in which describe what happens if you have non-symmetric stress tensors. And then, again, you have to reinvent the Chapman-Enskog expansion to take into account the friction. And the other question is, since most theories, especially those that are have been analyzed by mathematicians, but not only are frictionless, what does it mean? Is it okay to look at frictionless models? Or do we actually, in order to describe reality, need frictional models? Well, it turns out that you can do very well for some applications with frictionless models, but you have to be very careful because friction introduces a few new features which are important. So in this recent work that I'm describing, we do an expansion around the smooth limit. The smooth limit is the non-frictional limit. I'm not going into the model of friction. It's a complicated model that has to do with transition from Coulombic friction to non-Coulombic friction. There are lots of things going on there. However, let's look at the smooth limit. Now remember that particles that have friction also rotate because this creates a moment on the particles. If they rotate and to lowest order there is no friction, then they keep their rotation, their spin, their angular momentum, because to lowest order there's nobody to change it, no moment. So you can regard the collection of frictional particles to lowest order in the friction as a mixture of particles having different in angular momenta. So the mixture is defined, the index of the mixture is defined by their angular momenta, and so the distribution function of the density in this case is a function of the spin, which is just a velocity, its dimension, it's the diameter of a particle times the angular velocity of a location and of time. The distribution function, which will come later, will depend on velocity, spin, location, and time. So you have essentially a mixture of particles with different spin, and here is the interaction. It's not important. So, I mean, there's no reason to go into the interaction, but here is the new Boltzmann equation. How is it different? So first of all, you have these dynamic parameters, then there's the coefficient of normal restitution, the Coulomb friction, and some other frictional parameter which is non-Coulombic and has to come into the model. So you believe me that. You write down the equation, and the difference is that now you have, for the basic variable, you have spin and velocity, so this tau has six dimensions in three-dimensional space. And here this J is the Jacobian of the transformation between the pre-collisional velocities and spins, so the Jacobian of a 6x6 matrix, which is described here. I didn't know how to remove this line, but this Jacobian equals the coefficient of restitution times this non-Coulombic friction square in a certain regime, and it's, so basically there is a jump in this Jacobian because of the frictional model, which is quite realistic. And again, you do the continuum equations. That's easy. You just calculate moment of the Boltzmann equation. Now you have a density that depends, as I said, on the spin. And this is the equation of continuity, but there's a source term here. The reason is that particles of different spin interact, so there's no conservation law for particles of a given spin. And there are two source terms. One has to do with the relative velocity of particles of a given spin with respect to the average velocity around them, and the other is a gain term, essentially, for the spin. The momentum equation looks very similar, and the temperature equation has an energy sink because of the inelasticity. If you integrate the density equations over spin, you just regain the usual continuity equation, so there's no problem. And now you can actually do a Chapman-Enskog expansion again. And the variables here, the conserved variables, or in the limit, are essentially the temperature, the momentum density, and all the spin densities, because each one of them is separately conserved in the limit of no friction. So essentially, all of those are slow modes in the limit of in the elastic limit with no friction. It's an infinite number of equations if you regard S or the spin as a parameter. And the small parameters are the degree of inelasticity, the Knudsen number, and something to do with the non-Coulombic friction. So you can write down the Chapman-Enskog expansion, which I'm not going to show you. And here is the Chapman-Enskog expansion, these small parameters, and you can get constitutive relations. Now, when you get these constitutive relations, which again are quite cumbersome, so I'm not really going to show you, there is a strong influence of the spin on the various degrees of freedom. But what I am going to show you, actually, is the equation for the homogeneous cooling state. The homogeneous cooling state is a very simple system. You have a homogeneous system, the density is fixed, the energy decays, and the question is, how do you describe it then? So the homogeneous cooling state is described by the following equations here. You have just the temperature. Tau is sort of a renormalized time which measures the accumulated number of collisions. So instead of measuring time by time, you just count collisions, and that is your new time. So you have a set of coupled ordinary differential equations. This is an exact reduction of hydrodynamics. It's not an approximation anymore. So you have the temperature, the rotational temperature, which is nothing but the spin squared. And here is the macroscopic spin. Remember, there's the fluctuating spin squared gives you the rotational temperature. The average spin squared is the macroscopic spin. And essentially, you can solve these equations analytically. And let me show you the result. 1 minute? 2 minutes. So, ask again, it'll be 1 minute, half a minute. Okay, so let me show you the main results that you get there. Again, you define, this is the number density, which is a function of spin here, not of space, because we're talking about a homogeneous system. You multiply it by S squared for obvious reasons. You get the big N, and this is the equation satisfied by big N. And what is this equation? It's a diffusion equation. The spin diffuses in spin space. In real spin space, everything's homogeneous. There's no other space to diffuse in. It's a diffusion equation. Again, it's soluble. You make a simple transformation, and you get a solution for the diffusion equation. When zeta, which is the spin normalized by the square root of temperature, is large, it reduces to something, and you get the asymptotic result here for the spin distribution to be a power law in the spin. So the tail is a power law in the spin. It's not a Gaussian, no matter what you do. And here is a description of this distribution. Consider this to be spin. Forget about the scaling. So a Gaussian is the thick line, and what you have is the thin line. But this doesn't really bring out the main feature, so we've drawn the same thing. This is really the distribution in log, on a log scale as a function of spin squared. So this line here, obviously, is the Gaussian, because the log of E minus something squared as a function of squared is a straight line. And this is the correct distribution, which is the power law. And you have lots of other features that are quite interesting, including when you have shear flow. I'm not going to show you the details again, but in shear flow, again, the distribution of spins obeys a power law. Now, if you take that as interacting back on the velocity distribution, you also get a non-standard distribution, but that one will take a little bit more than 1 minute to explain. So this brings me to the last statement, which is my conclusion, to make you happy. And basically, I hope I've managed to convince you, first of all, that this is a worthwhile problem with much really industrial, physical, and mathematical interest. And there's been much progress on basically on all fronts in this problem. you stretch hydrodynamics to its limits and beyond, because you're actually applying hydrodynamics where it really shouldn't work, and a miracle happens and it does work, and I would like you to prove why it does work where it shouldn't work, because we have been bold enough to apply it without justification, so maybe you'll get us a good justification. We have unexpected, very exotic results like the Maxwell demon, for example. Every possible hydrodynamic flow, if you open up the book of Landau Lipschitz or Lamb or anybody on hydrodynamics, what you see there, you also see in granular materials and beyond. You have amplification of small effects like this anisotropic pressure, and I can assure you that there's much more fun ahead. Thank you very much.
Okay,